A-M-O-C-O, Amoco. Amoco presents the Edward R. Murrow Program with Larry Lesser. How many miles did you put on the family car this weekend? Picking up the groceries Saturday, a trip to the movies, that ride Sunday afternoon? It all adds up. First thing you know, you'll have another 1,000 miles recorded on the speedometer. That means take your car to your Amoco man for a thorough servicing. Service your car every 1,000 miles, and it will last many, many more thousands of miles. And now, Larry Lesser with the news.
Good evening, everyone. Here's what happened today. More communist pressure in Korea, a new communist pressure on the United Nations. That's the pattern of the day's military and diplomatic developments. Early this afternoon, the United States beat Russia to the draw, announced that we want the aggression in Korea to be the first item on tomorrow's UN agenda. America's chief delegate to the UN, Ambassador Austin, said, obviously referring to Russia, not all the members of the United Nations are supporting its peacemaking efforts. Almost immediately thereafter, the Russian representative, who assumes the presidency of the Council tomorrow, answered back, but by special courier. The Russian note said that the admission of Communist China to the UN should be the first order of business, Korea to come up after that question is discussed. How this difference of opinion is to be resolved is for the UN Council to settle. I'd like to go into some of the details of this problem in a few minutes. Against this background, the Defense Department tonight ordered 4 National Guard divisions to active duty about the 1st of September. We're not told which divisions have been alerted, but it's announced that supporting units, in addition to the 4 divisions, are also being called up. The order is expected to involve about 82,000 men. 2 Marine Air Reserve units are likewise being called up, on the advice of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And the Air Force is sending additional bombers to the Far East immediately. These will include more B-29s and some B-50s. That's a more powerful version of the B-29, and one of them recently circled the world on a nonstop flight. Additional American troops were landed in Korea during the night, the first troops to arrive there directly from this country. They were elements of the 2nd Infantry Division. They are the 4th American Division to take part in the Korean fighting. The Indian Head Division went ashore without incident, and presumably with no time to spare. Reports from the front indicate that the North Koreans have broken American defense positions west of Jinju, that's on the southern part of the line, have captured the city and its valuable airstrip, are now only about 50 miles west of our beachhead at Pusan. Our casualties after 3 days of fighting for Jinju are said to be fairly heavy, and Korean natives are now digging a new defense line between Jinju and the port of Pusan. North Korean attacks on the central front have eased somewhat, with the enemy shifting its pressure to the south and to the west. Army spokesmen say that the North Koreans are suffering heavy losses too, but they still are taking the offensive. Our air attacks are continuing on an around-the-clock schedule. Yesterday's heavy raid against a North Korean chemical plant damaged 85% of its facilities. In 5 weeks of air operations, we've knocked out 302 North Korean tanks and 44 planes. We've lost 43 planes. Bill Costello is in Tokyo with the story of the new American troop landings. After a few seconds' pause, we'll hear his recorded report.
American forces in Korea today received what 8th Army Commander General Walker called the extra muscle they needed to stop Korean communists driving on the vital southern port of Pusan. News quickly spread up and down the shrinking American sector that the 2nd Division had arrived, and the universal reaction was just in the nick of time. CBS correspondent Bill Downs, who was on the docks when the landing took place, said there was probably no group of Americans so glad to see another group of Americans as those who watched the GIs pulling into the harbor. He saw officers and men grinning like apes as these new powerful reinforcements stood leaning over the rails waiting to disembark. Many of the onlookers were sweat-stained, tattered officers and men who took part in the first gallant defense of the peninsula and who are now in town being resupplied before going back into the line. They knew, as the 2nd Infantry GIs probably did not, that the town of Jinju, only 65 miles west of Pusan, had fallen late Monday, and that a heavily reinforced communist army is sweeping eastward in what appears to be its major drive for quick victory. In contrast to the battered units already in Korea, the new troops look as good to Bill Downs as any fighting machine under the American flag. He said not only were their uniforms spick and span by comparison with the haggard, wrinkled, dusty men on the dockside, but all their equipment was good, and there was plenty of it. The new arrivals had everything from trench tools and knives to tanks in the hold. Aboard ship crossing the Pacific, they had been kept fit by daily setting up exercises, and they were given regular indoctrination in communist tactics and in the reasons for American participation in South Korea's defense. The new troops are green in battle, and it is, of course, anybody's guess as to how General Walker will employ them. But as one observer said, almost any road into the interior of Korea will soon lead to trouble. The men of the 2nd Division look young, but those who have had their baptism of fire predict they'll age 10 years in the first 48 hours of fighting. Certainly, they will be a vital contribution to the defense of Southeast Korea. Their presence promises to rob the communists of their last chance for a quick decision. This is Bill Costello recording in Tokyo. Now, back to Larry Lesueur in New York.
While immediate attention is focused on Korea, General MacArthur today made a surprise visit to Formosa. He met Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. Headquarters says it was in connection with the Truman Directive to protect Formosa from a Chinese communist invasion. The Senate is not going to cut the Marshall Plan for the third year of European recovery. It has voted to restore cuts made in committee, and the bill now stands intact at $2,726,000,000. However, an amendment has been attached to the bill. It gives the president authority to stop assistance to any country which ignores a United Nations appeal for help in fighting aggression. Tomorrow, the Senate will take up Senator McCarran's proposal to include a loan for Spain. The president also indicated he'll soon ask an additional $4 billion for military aid to non-communist countries. He told congressional leaders there's urgent need for arming our allies as quickly as possible. However, the House Appropriations Committee wants to keep non-military expenditures to a minimum. It's decided to look over this phase of the $29 billion appropriation bill passed by the House, with an eye towards cutting non-defense items. New York's Representative Tabor, a Republican, thinks the bill can be cut by as much as $1 billion. Another New Yorker, Governor Dewey, told a labor meeting today, "We may not need total mobilization now, but we do need total planning now, and we don't have it." But House Speaker Rayburn, after a White House meeting with the president, told newsmen, "Mr. Truman feels he has all the power he needs, provided Congress gives him what he asked for." If Congress wants to add standby wage, price, and rationing controls, Rayburn says the president will offer no strong objections. The Senate Banking Committee late today approved most of Mr. Truman's program. It held off until tomorrow its decision on standby powers. At the committee hearing, Senator Taft objected to the president's requests, said they would give him extreme and arbitrary powers. He thinks voluntary allocation agreements among industry would work. Favors mandatory allocation only for our armed forces, for atomic energy projects, and for military assistance programs. Taft says all-out mobilization might end our economic freedom forever. But the CIO tonight takes a different view. In a prepared statement, the union calls for immediate price control, standby rationing authority, and higher taxes. The CIO, however, says that even if prices are controlled, it does not favor a lid on wages. And the Atomic Energy Commission, in its semi-annual report, says atom bomb production has been at a record rate since January. Work on the hydrogen bomb has also been stepped up. And the commission notes that studies are being made on the possibilities of using radioactive poisons. The government has asked that CI Longshoreman President Harry Bridges should have his bail revoked and be sent to jail while he awaits an appeal on a prejudged conviction. Belgium's political crisis appears to have been eased tonight. King Leopold, who returned to the throne only 10 days ago, has agreed to surrender temporary powers to his eldest son. He'll abdicate next year when his son, Crown Prince Baudouin, becomes 21. Well, the communists have the military initiative in Korea, but they haven't got it at the UN. The diplomatic second front that the Russians hope to open up at Lake Success may bog down. The United States appears to have beaten them to the punch. We didn't land a diplomatic knockout blow today, but we did block the Soviet mystery punch. Russia is paying one of the penalties of a dictatorship, paying for the inflexible nature of its government. Now, the Russians are great showmen, love to keep their foreign policy surrounded by mystery in order to keep the spotlight focused upon them. But this time, they waited a little too long. Everyone may have been guessing what Russia would say when she returned to the UN tomorrow. But students of Russia knew there was only one thing Russia could say. It had to be what Stalin had already said 10 days or so ago. Because the fable must be kept alive in Russia that Stalin is never wrong. And the Soviet Union is not only a dictatorship, but it's an Asiatic dictatorship, just as sensitive as the Chinese about face. Russia could not come back to the UN in flat contradiction of what her delegate said when he walked out 6 months ago. In order not to lose face, the Soviet Union had to propose that the Chinese nationalists be ousted. The Western diplomats had it figured correctly. So today, while Russia was complacently wrapping up its next move in shrouds of mystery, the United States quickly proposed its own resolution, again asking all nations to condemn the aggression in Korea. And by UN rules, this should have priority on the order of business tomorrow, being the first resolution to be offered in writing. Meantime, the Russians were ponderously sending over their order of business by special courier. He arrived after the American motion had been placed on the table. The Russians were definitely out-timed. Tomorrow, as chairman for the month, the Russian representative will have some control over the council's discussions, but he's already been caught off base by the American proposal. The Russians have announced, in effect, that the admission of communist China is their price for ending the war in Korea. We say that both the Korean War and the Chinese situation must be discussed on their own merits, but that the Korean War comes first. So when Chairman Jacob Malik of Russia attempts tomorrow to place China first on the agenda, there will be a procedural row the like of which has not been heard for many months, not since the Russians walked out the last time. It will have to be voted upon by the rest of the council. But come what may, tomorrow at Lake Success, the Russian diplomatic offensive has already been blunted, its propaganda effect weakened. Russia's diplomatic second front is off to a poor start. This is Larry Lesser in New York. And now, Bob Dixon.
If you've ever poured cooking oil into a hot frying pan, you've noticed how it boiled and smoked and popped. Yet the cooking oil is protected from the actual flame by the pan. Now, motor oil, the oil that lubricates the piston as it slides up and down, has no protection. It is directly exposed to the gasoline flame. And do you know how hot that flame gets? Not a mere 500 degrees, like the heat of a frying pan, but up to 4,000 degrees. Ordinary oil smokes, burns up, turns into charred carbon. What your car needs is Permalube motor oil. It resists heat, keeps its oiliness. Moreover, Permalube motor oil is a detergent oil. It cleans as it lubricates, keeps dirt from sticking to moving parts, helps dissolve and clean away carbon. Next time you need oil, tell your Amoco man that's what you want. Permalube motor oil. It's great protection for your engine. Here's Mr. Lesser with a footnote to today's news.
Well, the boys in Korea are beginning to get their mail from home, and it's the old story. Everything is so different in a foxhole. Take Major Dan Kingman of Homestead, Florida. He got a letter from Philadelphia today. It was confirmation of the request he made in happier days for 2 tickets to the Army-Navy football game next December. And then there's Sergeant Ed Franklin of Chicago. He got a letter from the government, told him to report for active duty or face a court-martial. And that's my footnote for tonight.
There's an old saying that money makes the mare go. Today, a lot of motorists are finding out that less money makes the car go. These motorists use Amoco gas. Sure, they pay a slight premium at the pump, but on the road, they save money with Amoco gas, and not just in mileage costs either. They save right down the line in mileage and upkeep. With clean-burning Amoco gas, engines last longer, too. Yes, on every count, Amoco gas costs less to use. Listen tomorrow to Larry Lesser. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.